This program is a theoretical account of the events that occurred on the morning of July the 2nd, 1937, and thereafter. Although she was declared dead in absentia on January the 5th, 1939, the Amelia Earhart disappearance case is considered by many to be unsolved. Vanished Amelia Earhart is recorded in its entirety with the Zoom H1N microphone. Get yours now at zoom-na.com. I'm standing on the banks of the Missouri River, close to the corner of Santa Fe and Terrace Street in Atchison, Kansas. It's right before sundown in the middle of winter, and it's cold. Across from me is a home. In some ways, it's like most homes in Atchison. Unassuming, two stories, quaint and indicative of the time. Its wood-frame Gothic Revival cottage style is one that wouldn't normally be noticed if you weren't drawn to that style of the time. However, this home I'm standing across from right now, it's the birthplace of a legend. If you've been following the Chasing Earhart podcast for the last 70-plus episodes, then you're pretty versed in who Amelia Earhart was, what she stood for, and why so many people seem to care so much about her ultimate fate. But for those of you that haven't joined the chase, or for those that need a refresh, here you go.
Get your ticker tape ready and tear up your confetti, cause it's gonna be a big parade.
She didn't like the fame. But she accepted it because it was what she had to do if she was going to accomplish what she wanted to do, which was to inspire women to get off their duffs and do what they wanted to do, you know?
She'll be the first girl to do it. They'll fly around the world. So don't forget who flew it. Have that bunting unfurled. When Amelia Earhart circles the globe and comes flying home again.
It does not take courage so much to go as it does interest in the task. I believe that women have as much courage as men.
The round-the-world ladybird and her crew, ready for an adventure that nobody has ever tried before. Amelia Earhart, out to circle the Earth at the latitude of the equator, and that's the Earth's greatest circle.
We held our breath when she finally took off from Oakland for Honolulu. A few of us knew she thought this would be her swan song. I have a feeling, she wrote to her husband, that there is just about one more good flight left in my system. I hope this trip is it. When I've finished, I mean to give up long-distance stunt flying.
If any of our sex can make it, Amelia's the girl.
The disappearance of Amelia Earhart, one of America's biggest mysteries, may finally be solved.
The story of a brave woman of the air enters a shroud of mystery.
Contemplated course covers about 27,000 miles. It will be the first flight, if successful, which approximates the equator.
The plane, of course, she tried to go around the world in has been missing since 1937. And now this photograph, unearthed by history investigators from the National Archives, appears to show Earhart and Fred Noonan, her navigator, on the dock in the Marshall Islands. For 80 years, the world has wondered what happened to Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan.
Earhart disappeared in July of 1937, and ever since, theory after theory of her fate has intrigued generations.
Despite a wide search at the time, few clues exist as to what happened to Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan.
We have a Caucasian woman with her back to the camera, sitting there looking over towards the ship.
You think this is Amelia Earhart?
We just follow the evidence wherever it leads.
Are you kidding me? That's Fred Noonan.
I don't even know it's a woman. I thought it's a man. Everybody's talking about her, but they're talking in Japanese. That's why I know that she's a woman. They're talking about woman flyer.
And I went over and I met this couple and I looked this lady straight in the face and I knew who it was as soon as I looked at her. Amelia Earhart. I would know her anywhere in the world.
The fantastic story which makes me out to be some kind of a mystery woman is utter nonsense. I am not a mystery woman. I am not Amelia Earhart.
The airplane was parked there, safe landing, on its wheels, for at least 5 nights while she sent radio distress calls.
Is there a simpler explanation for the whole thing?
People ask me, what do you think happened to Amelia? And my answer is, I don't have an opinion, and it's not important. I don't care what happened to her. It doesn't matter anymore. What we care about and what we should focus on is her accomplishments, the things that she gave to the world.
Before she took off, Amelia wrote to her husband,
"Please know that I am quite aware of the hazards. I want to do it because I want to do it. Women must try as men have tried. When they fail, their failure must be but a challenge to others."
All right, got it. Now that that's out of the way, we can begin. A lot of attention has been paid to how Amelia's life ended and everything that's gone on since then, but not so many people have looked at how it began. We're guilty of it here at Chasing Earhart. So let's right that wrong now and talk about it. After all, I've always been a firm believer that you can't fully understand an ending until you fully understand the beginning. As we begin this journey together, let's make one thing clear. I am not an expert on Amelia Earhart. There aren't many subjects that you can study for the majority of your life and still be a newcomer, but when it comes to Amelia, I am very much a newcomer. The guests that make up the Chasing Earhart Project and the guests that you hear on this podcast, those are the stars of the show. Now, with that being said, you may be asking yourself how I'm qualified to be doing this. The short answer is, I'm not. But we'll get back to that soon enough. For now, let's begin with the question that we've yet to ask anywhere in our project. Are legends born or made? It's a fundamental but appropriate question as we begin our journey together tonight. To help answer that question, I decided to do what anyone in my position would do. I made a phone call.
From everything that I ever read about Amelia and all the, you know, the sign of sort of telltale little sources and tales that I uncovered while I was researching the book, Amelia was always a very outgoing, very contented, and a very curious little girl from the time that she was a baby. I have a line in my book. I think she told her mother if there was nobody around, she talked into her own ears.
In 2009, Susan Butler released East to the Dawn, what many people believe to be the definitive biography on Amelia Earhart. Years of painstaking research went into the creation of her work, tracing Amelia's story back to before she was ever born. I figured, if you're going to start at the beginning, it doesn't get any better. I wanted to start with the people that surrounded Amelia during her upbringing. To understand the legend, you have to understand the people that provided her foundation. That almost always starts with one's mother. In this case, Amy Otis Earhart.
Amy was Amelia's mother. She was born in Atchison, Kansas. She was a very gutsy young girl. She loved horseback riding. She was a very bright girl. At her coming out party in Atchison, Kansas, she fell in love and ended up marrying her husband, who was a man called Edwin Earhart. He was a lawyer who had also grown up in Kansas, although he had never been in Atchison before.
So we know a little about Amy Otis. She was quite a woman in her own right, as Susan describes. So what was it about Edwin that Amy found so appealing?
He was good looking. He was charming. He was actually, when he was younger, he was actually a very hard worker. He went to Field College on a scholarship and became a lawyer. But somehow the law did not work for him. He was not a successful lawyer. And so although he was a charming man and also a very good father, because he loved his daughters, Amelia and her younger sister, Muriel, and he gave them all kinds of things and everything they asked for. And Amelia was a bit of a tomboy, and so he gave her BB guns, and he gave her a .22, and a football, but he was not a successful lawyer, and that caused great, great problems. As he fell behind his peers, he started to drink, which of course caused much greater problems. A lot of it, when Amelia was young, she was insulated from all that because she'd been sent to live with her grandmother, with Amy's mother, who lived in Atchison.
We all have flaws, and for Edwin, it was alcohol. That flaw, though, would haunt Amelia for the rest of her life and really become something that many people believed came full circle and tied to the world flight. But not with Edwin, of course, with someone else. More on that later. But how did she really feel about her father's drinking at such an early age?
They used to play a game when they were in Des Moines, Iowa, cowboys and Indians, and they waited for him to come home. And when he came home, he stumbled and lurched. And as they watched him go into the house, he was obviously and embarrassingly drunk. I don't think there's any question about it. By the time that she was an adult and living with George Palmer Putnam, they were building a house in California, she would not let anybody in the house drink an alcoholic drink. She felt very strongly about it.
Although it's clear that he cared deeply for his daughters, Amelia's relationship with her father Edwin was a strained one, and his alcohol abuse clearly had an effect on her for the rest of her days. However, Amy and Edwin weren't the only parental figures in Amelia's young life, and that brings us to her reason for calling Atchison, Kansas, a crucial part of her foundation.
Alfred Otis had been a dynamo, one of the early settlers in the town of Atchison, and also an abolitionist. And he had been instrumental, basically, in starting everything that ever happened in Atchison, including the bank. But he had had a nervous breakdown and became very withdrawn. And that left his wife, Amy's mother, Amelia's grandmother, whose name was also Amelia, left her sort of adrift and alone. And so Amelia Earhart was such a charming little girl that the decision was made that she would go and she would spend her winter months and go to school in Atchison and live with her grandmother and cheer up her grandmother. So she had a very different upbringing up until she was 12 from Muriel, who lived in Kansas City with her mother, Amy.
Muriel stays in Kansas, and Amelia heads off to Atchison to live with her grandparents. A lot of us can relate to Amelia's close relationship with her grandparents. After all, there are many of us who share that same kind of relationship with our own. I'm sure you've heard the phrase, "it takes a village," before. I wondered if this was the case like so many of us. What Susan said got me thinking, and so I had to ask. Did Amelia really have two sets of parents, so to speak, that contributed to the foundation of who she would eventually become?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think that's a very good description of her childhood, that Amy and her mother and her grandmother, really basically shared Amelia Earhart, because she was a very self-reliant, interesting, fun child.
And she was also different in a few other ways that gave us all a small glimpse of how Amelia would challenge the status quo all of her life.
You know, she enjoyed shooting a BB gun when she saw boys playing basketball at her school, at College Preparatory School. She asked the top basketball player to teach her how to play basketball. Nothing stood in her way. She was a very curious little girl, and she was very bright. So I don't think she was knocking herself out to do a lot of studying. And she spent a lot of time with her cousins, Catch and Lucy.
Catch and Lucy. More on them in a bit. There have been a lot of books written on various theories as to what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan the morning of July the 2nd, 1937. But as I said earlier, this episode isn't about any of that. After talking to Susan about her extraordinary book, I wanted to drill down even more into Amelia's childhood and try to uncover some of the stories that aren't so famous. To understand the legend, we must understand the woman. To understand the woman, we must understand the girl. In order to do that, I need to talk with someone that has devoted their work to the years before Amelia became a legend in the sky.
She had a wonderful nuclear family and as well as an extended family.
That's author J.A. Keel. She wrote Amelia, the Town and the People That Loved Her, and she's writing more stories that focus on the foundation of Amelia's character, like next year's Splat and Mealy's Christmas. I traveled out to meet with her in Lawrence, Kansas, just about an hour away from Atchison. Her books aren't about the disappearance, and they don't promote any theory. As Keel describes it, they're love stories, and they're personal.
She was surrounded with her grandmother and her grandfather, who was instrumental in her life. He would read to her at a very, very young age. And then also, because of him reading to her, she began to teach herself to read. And she could read before she entered elementary school, the College Preparatory School of Atchison.
I wanted to find out more. I was interested in some of the stories that aren't so widely circulated about Amelia when she was a little girl. And J.A. didn't disappoint.
Grandmother Otis's sister was basically a next-door neighbor, the Chalices. They had actually lived on the opposite corner of North Terrace in Atchison. They lived on the south corner. And I believe it was 1899. Their house caught on fire at Christmas time. I think somebody forgot to extinguish a candle. And they decided to rebuild. It was a frame house, but it was a very, very large, impressive home. They decided not to rebuild there, but to move up next door to the Otises. So you had two sisters living next door to each other. And today, though, there is a separation. There is a house now between where Amelia lived and where the Chalices lived. But the Chalices had children, and Amelia was extremely close to her cousins, Catch and Lucy. They played together all the time. And Grandmother Otis, having come from a wealthy family in Philadelphia, had always wanted Amelia to be kind of girly. She would arrange for tea parties, and I think in my mind I can see Amelia rolling her eyes, thinking, why do I have to do this? And when I'd rather be exploring the caves on the other side, on the bluff across from us. That was something that she did so often. And actually, as a child, I did the very same thing.
Yeah, you just heard that right. Amelia Earhart was a spelunker.
The caves are are not very large. They're maybe 20 feet in depth at the maximum, but they're dotted all along that bluff. And so one of her favorite things to do was to go past the orchard fence, hop over, and go down and explore the caves. Her grandmother was not too fond of her doing that, but Amelia was very daring, and that's what she wanted to do. She also was surrounded by other friends. She had a close friend named Dolan. That was not her first name. That was her last name. But all the children, it was Catherine Dolan. The children simply called her Dolan. And then another close friend, childhood friend of hers, was Bailey P. Wagoner. And I can only imagine, I mean, I do know some of the stories there, and I can only imagine the things that they must have done together because they were both adventuresome children. She liked to do boyish type things. And grandmother was not too fond of that because she felt she should be more ladylike. But Amy and Edwin were very encouraging of her to, you know, it doesn't make any difference if you're a girl and you want to play football or you want to go sledding with the boys and have snowball fights and all of that. No, they thought it was wonderful.
J.A. then told us a story that will be part of one of her upcoming books, a story that took place during one of the winters in Atchison.
It was a snowy day in Atchison. That's when they used to have a lot of snow. And she and Bailey got up on top of the roof of a carriage house and decided to sled off of it. And boy, did they fly. And that was something very memorable for Amelia. And they also did a lot of sleigh riding on their sleds down the Second Street Hill. And it is very, very steep. And the story goes that she was at the top of the hill. The kids were all watching. And by the time she got to the bottom, there was a cart pulled by horses that was coming through. And I think all the children were horrified But Amelia made it, and she slipped right between the wheels and passed the cart so she did not get hit. She also loved ice skating. The kids went ice skating all the time. She just had a marvelous, fun childhood.
Amelia had the daredevil bug in her genes long before she ever got up into the sky. In fact, you might be able to say that her first flight came long before Frank Hawks took her up on December the 28th, 1920. And like a lot of Amelia's professional career, this one too was marred in controversy. It's simply known as the roller coaster incident. Susan Butler.
She'd been at a World's Fair. Amy had not let her go on the roller coaster there. So she got back to Atchison and she decided she wanted to, you know, she decided to create a roller coaster. So she found some 2x4s and she propped them up on the edge of a shed. And she had her uncle Carl, Amy, her mother's brother, helping her. And she made a box and had a wonderful time. And the first time she went down on it, she somersaulted, but then she got it in shape. And it was evidently a great success. And not just she went to, took a ride on it, but her friend Bailey Wagoner took a ride on it. It was a very creative thing for a young girl to do.
As Amelia grew, she faced new challenges. Moving around a lot made it difficult to find a source of stability. By the time she found herself in high school, Amelia was trying to make her way and decide on what she wanted to do with her professional life. Was she really known as, quote, the girl in brown who walked alone? A wonderful line that helps build the legend. But is it true?
I found her yearbook, and that was not what was said. What the yearbook quote around her about her was, meek loveliness is round thee spread. By the time high school rolled around, her father had gotten a job in Des Moines, Iowa, and it was there that he started to drink. And then by the time they got to St. Paul, they rolled around a bit because he kept losing jobs and trying to find jobs, and they had to keep moving. So it wasn't until they got to St. Paul Central High School that she started to enjoy herself and played basketball. Edwin was such a disaster that he and Amy split. And Amelia and Amy and her sister Muriel went to Chicago by themselves and took rooms in an apartment where some old ladies lived. And she went to Hyde Park High School. And that's where she graduated from.
And this is where it gets real interesting real fast. The next several years of Amelia's life were a whirlwind, with Amelia going through multiple incidents and experiences that would take her from a boarding school to a stint as a nurse during World War I that would result in near death, and to what she thought would be her lifelong career as a social worker. But as we all are well aware, destiny was calling, and it had other plans.
She went to Ogontz, which was a girls' boarding school. She was there for a year and a half. She was there because her mother had come in some money so that she could afford to go to a girl. It was basically a girls' finishing school. Then she went up to Canada to visit Muriel, who was at school up in Toronto. This was in 1918, and she was there when the Canadian soldiers were coming back from the war, and she was there when the grand flu pandemic hit. And she became a nurse's aide and went to work in Toronto hospitals taking care of flu and pneumonia patients.
There's one thing about Amelia that a lot of people agree on. She had a distaste for war. Remember that. It may come back into play in the future. At this point, another hotly contested aspect makes its introduction to Amelia's life, her chronic sinus issues that would plague her during her career as an aviatrix. It's also important to note here that her sinus condition, and more important, her treatment for it or lack thereof, depending on where you sway, will play a huge part in her disappearance. Yes, you heard that right.
I mean, here she had come from a very sort of a very posh boarding school, and the moment that she had a chance, she went to work taking care of sick soldiers without really due regard to the danger. She had a sinus condition that she had all her life. She always had problems. After that, as a result of that, after she recovered, because she was quite sick for a while, she decided to be a doctor, and quite hard to be a doctor until she ran out of money. But of course, then she became a social worker. That was more important. I mean, I really do think that if she hadn't been such a successful pilot, and she hadn't been sort of grabbed by at the moment when flying was the most important thing to everybody, sort of like space exploration is to us right now, I think she would have ended up as one of another Jane Addams who ran Hull House. She was well on the way to being one of the top social workers in Boston.
Amelia Earhart, the social worker, the doctor, the president? Was this woman simply a slam dunk to be the best at whatever road she decided to walk down? And perhaps more importantly, did Amelia Earhart conquer fear?
She probably could have succeeded at whatever she did. She was well coordinated. She was smart. She had a wonderful ability to stay relaxed. She never seemed to ever get uptight about anything, which is why she was such a record-setting pilot, because whereas other pilots would get anxious and start to overplan, she never overplanned. If she had extra time before a flight, she would curl up and take a nap. She was not a worrier. She just was a very successful person. I don't know how you explain why one person succeeds and another doesn't, except that she was always very aware of what she was doing. She always kept her mind on the task at hand.
Having said all of that, we can now approach the question that we asked at the beginning of this episode. Are legends born or made? I had to ask Susan if it was a fair assessment for me to say that Amelia willed herself into becoming a legend.
Yes, I think that is safe to say. I'm not sure whether she knew it or not, or whether she just was a natural leader. In my book, I have quotes of the other girls around her who said that they waited to see what she was going to do because whatever she planned was much more exciting than what they had planned. And I do think that when she was older, that she was aware that she was a really great influence. After all her years at Purdue, where she was teaching women, were for her a great fun, and she knew she was making a difference with the college girls that were following her around. They all adored her.
Throughout her career, the one thing that Amelia always encouraged people to do was dream. And then do everything in your power to act on and accomplish those dreams. During my interview with J.A. Keel, I learned something that I hadn't previously known about Amelia, and it gave me chills.
I did not know this, actually, until I was 66 years of age. When I needed to think, I would go to the bluff across the street from where Amelia lived. And I knew that was her home. Her childhood home, because she had been my father's heroine, and he had some wonderful encounters with her. But I would go up and sit on the bluff and watch the river go by and dream my dreams, and I would look back at her home, and I would think very seriously about her and what she had done. And I would do that. I did that so many times as a child. Well, at the age of 66, I became a docent. I was asked to become a docent for the Amelia Earhart Birthplace Museum. And I was telling some children that I was guiding through the museum one day about the fact that I would sit on the bluff and dream my dreams. And our manager at that time, the first manager of the museum, Louise Foudre, came to me and she said, "I did not realize you did that." And I said, "Oh yes, so many times I would ride my bike over there." And she said, "Do you know that Amelia did the very same thing?" And she said, "Show me where you used to sit." So we went out to the front porch and I pointed to where I would sit. She gave me a point. She said, "Do you see that spot?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "That is where Amelia sat. And she did the same thing that you did. She would dream her dreams there." And she knew that because when Amelia's sister Muriel was still living, she paid a number of visits to that home. And she talked to Louise Foudre a couple times. And it was Muriel that told Louise that story. And so I sat about 20 yards from where Amelia sat, and we dreamt our dreams together.
Louise Foudre. Louise curated the Amelia Earhart Birthplace Museum in Atchison for 30 years. She's one of the most knowledgeable people in the world when it comes to Amelia. I had the pleasure of sitting down with Louise for the show, and I cannot wait for everyone to hear from her. You think you know stories? You ain't heard nothing yet. A little girl, born into a loving family, but a family not without controversy. An adventurous spirit that would be nurtured instead of denied. And a name that the entire planet would remember forever. Are legends born or made? Can someone will themselves into greatness? As William Shakespeare wrote in his play Twelfth Night, quote, some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. J.A. Keel.
Those people that she knew, those people who loved her, and she had so much of an impact on, I think do draw on her. With women being now on the map because of Amelia, she put women on the map for what she did and what she accomplished. I think that that is absolutely wonderful. Many women, and men as well, draw on that strength, look back and draw on that strength and say, what was it in Amelia that I want to exemplify?
Susan Butler.
When I was working on her years at Purdue as a teacher there, I put an ad into the yearbook, and I asked anybody who was a student then if they remembered Amelia Earhart, if they would write me of their impressions. And I got letters from these women who wrote me that she had changed their life. One woman said that she started out in home ec, and she'd wanted to be an engineer, but the engineering staff at Purdue didn't want women to be in their classes because they were all men and they were all basically misogynist, according to these women, and that Amelia encouraged them to go and do whatever they wanted and change their lives.
That wraps it up for episode 1 of Vanished Amelia Earhart. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope that tonight you learned a little something about Amelia that you didn't know previously. We'll have much more from J.A. Keel as Vanished Amelia Earhart continues. I want to thank J.A. as well as Susan for joining me tonight. We'll have links in the show notes for this episode to both their books. A special thank you to the entire Chasing Earhart team for helping me put together this first episode. If you enjoyed tonight's show, please head to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or any of the popular podcast platforms to subscribe and leave us a rating. It really does help. More coming your way soon. We'll see you next time.